Lecture 21, The Bismarckian System.
In this lecture, we'll be examining how Bismarck created structures that were meant to deal with a new situation that he himself had created in Europe through German unification. In our previous lecture, we had examined the process by which Bismarck had, in essence, created the so-called German Revolution of uniting the German lands around the hard core of Prussia. Today, we'll examine precisely how it was he tried to deal with the new challenges of the new situation of this new German power. After Bismarck had forged the German Empire, the challenge that now faced him was finding a way of reconciling the other neighbors of this new powerful Germany to the very fact of the German Revolution that he had created. The answer that Bismarck presented to this problem, in a way that really used his talent for self-limitation, was to seek to present the new Germany no longer as an expansionist power with aggressive intentions, but rather as a guarantor of stability in Europe. In this lecture, we'll examine the period from 1871, the founding of the German Empire, all the way to Bismarck's fall from office in 1890, and we'll look beyond that to around 1894, when the system that he had built finally broke down. Thus, we'll examine the building, the functioning, and then the eventual breakdown of the Bismarckian system of diplomacy, which could not long outlast Bismarck leaving the scene. We'll consider the repeated crises that were weathered by the European state system in this period, the immensely complicated and tangled webs of alliances that were purposefully woven by Bismarck, and, on a more ominous note, the perilous trends that were continually strengthening through this time. First of all, we want to say a few words about the spirit of the age itself and the logic of Bismarck's actions in the immediate aftermath of the German Revolution he had engineered. After German unification, the period from 1871 all the way to 1914, the outbreak of the First World War, has been called in general an era of stability. Certainly, given the turmoil of two world wars that would follow afterwards, it looked awfully good in retrospect. The challenge that faced statesmen in this period was how to find new principles that might renew or reconstruct a balance after the destruction, for practical terms, of the concert of Europe. At the same time, there were other trends strengthening in the period, in particular growing nationalism, which had to be considered in foreign affairs as a new factor in ways that it had not been in the course of the 18th century. Now, this was especially worrying to multi-ethnic empires like Austria or the Russian Empire, which after all were not simply nation states, but rather were tremendously diverse multi-ethnic collections of territories. The very strength of nationalism in this period, growing strength of nationalism, also did something else very interesting in the world of diplomacy. It injected new passions, new hatreds, as well as new affinities into what earlier had been conflicts that had been between monarchs, between ruling houses and their cabinets and their trained statesmen. These now threatened to become far larger clashes between entire peoples with societies invested in the outcome. Another very interesting trend in this period that we'll trace in our lectures was an increase in demands based on human rights, also arising in diplomatic negotiations, as well as in public interest in diplomacy. And all of this was part and parcel of a larger trend, the expansion of the very scope of diplomacy. One aspect of technological change, which was especially swift in the 19th century, was that quicker technologies for communication altered earlier patterns. Just think of the impact of the telegraph and telegrams flying back and forth in the context of negotiations, and all of this conspired to change the role of the diplomat or the diplomatist, as this office was sometimes called in the period, in ways that were really remarkable and changed the very nature of diplomacy. We might sum it up thus: public attention and public opinion were engaged in observing diplomacy and maybe even contributing to the making of diplomacy as one of the factors that diplomats had to keep in mind, making diplomacy ever less a preserve of a tiny elite, though it still remained very much an elite role, It rather was widening out and becoming something far more all-encompassing in social terms. Among all of these other factors, the role of personality also mattered. And we're going to focus in this lecture in particular on Bismarck himself and the remarkable role that he played in structuring the era. Because when you get right down to it, Bismarck dominated the 20 years that followed 1870 with his very personal stamp in diplomacy. Bismarck, as we had mentioned in our previous lecture, was gifted with self-restraint, in addition to being a master of brinksmanship. Bismarck now that he had achieved what he saw as the German unification that would secure Prussia's role as a great power, he now shifted to work for peace and to stabilize Germany among the great powers in a new role as a satisfied power. And this was crucial. Bismarck again and again tried to convince neighboring great powers that Germany had nothing else that it might want. It now was through with change, was no longer a revisionist power, but now he claimed had become a status quo power, seeking to preserve the current balance of power. And thus, Bismarck also was able to offer Germany's role as one of being an honest broker between the other great powers. He hoped that this new role for the new Germany might diffuse the new German problem, no longer one as it had been in previous ages of German weakness or a power vacuum in the German lands, now instead the German problem of the great power that Germany possessed. The formula that Bismarck avowed and that he constantly kept in mind was this: in the game of the great powers, of which there were five, he wanted Germany to always be in a coalition of three. That meant to be on the winning side in the more powerful coalition of the great powers. One reason why this was so existentially important was because Bismarck, who was capable, as we had mentioned earlier, of staying up all night hating his political enemies, he also was sometimes kept up at night by a nightmare, a particular fear, what he called the nightmare of coalitions. And this was the anxiety that Bismarck had that earlier had been shared by Frederick the Great in his times of great peril in the Seven Years' War and around that time, of Germany finding itself encircled on all sides by a coalition of all the great powers, which inevitably would lead to a tremendously threatening situation for Germany. How to deal with this nightmare of coalitions then was the central problem for Bismarck. And at least one answer loomed up very vividly for him. An imperative had to be to isolate France. France, the hereditary enemy, still embittered about the loss of the provinces of Alsace-Lorraine and the humiliation of the war that France had just lost, the imperative was to isolate that France and try to keep it weak. The other great powers had to, in some sense, be distracted. And for that reason, Bismarck did something very interesting. He encouraged the imperialism overseas of other European powers. We'll talk more about imperialism as a trend in a coming lecture. But what was very interesting in this context was that Bismarck, while he encouraged others, did not set Germany on the road towards imperialism. There was a very famous incident where Bismarck had met with an especially passionate German colonial advocate, someone who wanted lots of German expansion, who'd brought a map of Africa and pointed to territories here, here, and here that he thought Bismarck should consider Germany occupying and annexing. Bismarck told him, in a very famous response that really says a lot about Bismarck's approach to the European balance of power, he said, "Your map of Africa is very nice. You want to see my map of Africa? My map of Africa is this. Here's Germany in the center, there's France, and there's Russia. That's my map of Africa." What Bismarck was trying to suggest was that Germany's role, so problematic in the balance of power and so potentially threatened on all sides, meant that it had to obey an entirely different logic than other European great powers. Another imperative that Bismarck derived from the existential situation of his new Germany was the crucial cornerstone of his diplomacy, in addition to isolating France, friendship with Russia. Friendship with that great conservative empire, Russia, to the east. He claimed that there was no reason and should be no reason for Germany or Russia to ever break their conservative solidarity. They should instead build upon it. He also sought an alliance with the weaker great power of Austria-Hungary, which, as a power that was ruled by the German-speaking House of Habsburg, had affinities with Germany. There was an implicit problem here. Russia in the East and Austria-Hungary in the East were mutual rivals. So it would be a challenge for Bismarck. We'll trace this process in this lecture, especially to make sure that these two mutual rivals didn't come into conflict with one another and drag Germany in. Essentially, the bottom line was this. For Bismarck, Germany had to remain at the center of international politics and alliances as an indispensable part of the equation. And thus, Bismarck's maintenance of the European balance of power, in his mind, had to be not something passive, where you simply hope that everything would turn out okay, but rather an active undertaking, an active act of balance and of seeking to ensure alliances that would entangle everybody, in essence. Now, there was one other potential problem that Bismarck was slow to recognize, given his more conservative predilections. Germany itself was changing in this entire period. Its economic power was growing to the point where it would soon outpace that of Britain. And this in and of itself, in spite of Bismarck's conservative calculations and foreign policy, would nonetheless make other great powers worry about Germany's potential might on the continent. Bismarck now set about an active policy of ensuring that his calculations would come to pass. Having earlier done so much with his realist policies to smash the conservative Holy Alliance of the Eastern courts of Prussia, Russia, and Austria, Bismarck now essentially reversed course by reconstituting that earlier conservative solidarity, or trying to, with the establishment of the so-called Dreikaiserbund, or Three Emperors League, of 1873. Bismarck's goal, by tying Austria-Hungary, Germany, and Russia together in this alliance, was to diffuse tensions that were already growing between Russia and Austria in the Balkans and over the Eastern question. Being tied to them in an alliance, he hoped, would allow him to, as it were, work for peace and to smooth relations between them. The other very desirable corollary that flowed from this alliance was that it further isolated France. If Russia and Austria-Hungary were allied with Germany, France would not be able to find, in that group at least, a potential ally. And indeed, this Three Emperors League would function practically until 1875, until it broke down in the context of the Great Eastern Crisis that we'll talk about in a moment. There was one incident, however, tremendously threatening and full of peril at the time that we want to look at first. In 1875, so soon after the Franco-Prussian War of 1870 to 1871, it seemed as if war might be on the horizon again. France had managed to pay off its reparations, its so-called indemnity to Germany, with unexpected speed. France began to rearm, and many French politicians continued to nurse in their hearts the grievance and the humiliation that they had felt at France's defeat, and to long for the lost provinces of Alsace-Lorraine. One very common slogan of the times was about these lost provinces: think of them always, speak of them never. Tensions were growing between France and Germany, and Bismarck apparently launched a press campaign to, as it were, test the political winds by encouraging German newspapers that were close to the government itself to discuss the possibility of preventive war against France. Well, Bismarck very quickly saw that there was very little tolerance among the great powers for another German crushing of France. Both Great Britain and Russia unmistakably warned Germany as a result of this war in sight crisis, as it came to be called, with a question mark, was war almost here? They warned Germany emphatically that they would not allow France to be attacked again, because this would totally upset the balance of power. And Bismarck now saw that he, in earnest, had to work for a balance of power. It was imperiled, however, as an idea by the Great Eastern Crisis of 1875 to 1878. This was once again a recurrence of the Eastern question that we've discussed in earlier lectures. In Russia and in Eastern Europe, a powerful ideology with a lot of appeal to nationalists had grown up called Pan-Slavism. This was a kind of nationalism that didn't apply just to one nation, but rather the greater family of Slavic peoples, including Russians, Poles, Czechs, many other Slavic peoples of Eastern Europe. And this ideology of Pan-Slavism proclaimed the message of Slavic brotherhood under the patronage of the great power of Russia. Now, in spite of the rhetoric and occasional enthusiasm among some Russian leaders for Pan-Slavism, Russian foreign policy, to the frustration of many Pan-Slavists, on occasion could follow much more pragmatic dictates of its own great power interest, and thus was not totally consistent on the pan-Slavist line. But the ratcheting up of pan-Slavist rhetoric was tremendously worrying to Austria-Hungary with its large Slavic minorities. Austria-Hungary, we'll recall, was existentially threatened by nationalism in its own lands, and it also sought to preserve the Ottoman realm's existence in the Eastern question as a way of making sure that Austria-Hungary was not next on the list as the next sick man of Europe. Bismarck, for his part, for obvious reasons, was determined to avoid blow-ups between his own allies in the Balkans. And he declared famously in 1875, as tensions were growing, that the entire area of the Balkans, as far as he was concerned, was not worth the bones of a single Pomeranian grenadier. That's to say, a German soldier. He just didn't see this as anything that really was an authentic problem. And it was something that he wanted to somehow manage to allay. A double spark, unwelcome to Bismarck, came with two events in the Balkans. In July of 1875, a revolt broke out in Bosnia-Herzegovina against Ottoman rule within the Ottoman realm. And shortly thereafter, in June 1876, Serbia and Montenegro, which formally were under the Ottomans but practically were driving towards independence, went to war against the Ottomans but were soon defeated as well. To add a third problem to this entire dreadful and bloody complex of Eastern problems, we should mention also that in April of 1876, an uprising had taken place in Bulgaria, and massacres of thousands of Bulgarian Christians had aroused an international outcry against the Ottoman Turks. You'll recall that in an earlier lecture on British politics, Gladstone had mounted a tremendously loud campaign against the immoral foreign policy of Disraeli of supporting the Ottomans when they were committing such atrocities. For its part, Russia was not willing to stand aside when Orthodox Christians were being threatened, and it prepared to intervene against the Ottoman Empire, gaining a promise of Austrian neutrality in exchange for the promise that in the future, Austria would gain the important territory in the Balkans of Bosnia-Herzegovina. I might mention that if many of these regions in the Balkans sound familiar to the current ear, it's because in our own times, these are places where violence had flared up dreadfully as well. Russia now, in essence, returned from its long retreat from European affairs that had followed upon the Crimean War and its defeat there to launch the Russo-Turkish War of 1877 to 1878, when Russian forces marched on Constantinople and seemed to be approaching it. British public opinion, showing sometimes the volatility of public opinion in an open society, now swung around from condemning the Ottomans to a condemnation of Russia for what was seen as its aggressive intentions. This was known as a mood of jingoism after a famous song of the times that was sung by British nationalists in which it was said that we don't want to fight, but by jingo, if we have to, we have the men, we have the guns, we have the money too. And jingoism, the notion of sort of an exaggerated nationalism, takes its name from precisely this period of heightened tensions. Inevitably, the British fleet was sent to Constantinople and Russia had to back down, agreeing to the writing of a peace. But when peace was negotiated between Russia and the Ottomans, the result was shocking to the international audience. This was the very harsh Peace of San Stefano of 1878, which redrew the Balkans and carved out a huge Bulgarian state that would be under Russian patronage, as well as independence for Romania, Serbia, and Montenegro. Britain and Austria, feeling that they had an interest in the Balkans, reacted with outrage at this huge Bulgaria under Russian domination that threatened to emerge. So Bismarck now hosted, in the role that he claimed for himself as an honest broker, a month-long Berlin Congress, as it was called. This is sort of a revival of the traditions of the Concert of Europe, one of the last occasions in which the tradition of having a Congress would work. Indeed, the last Congress that was held in the Concert of Europe system. Bismarck, as he sought to lessen tensions, formulaically began all of his sentences with a statement, "Germany, as everyone knows, has no direct interest in Eastern questions." And then he tried to lessen the tensions. Russia agreed to attend, represented by Gorchakov, its foreign minister, and typically a compromise had already been reached behind the scenes by Britain, that was represented at the Congress by Disraeli and Salisbury, and Russia beforehand. It's probably just as well that agreement had actually been ironed out beforehand, because leaving things to the last moment would have been dangerous, to say the least, because Disraeli's French, which was the language in which negotiations were in obligatory sense conducted in the diplomacy of the day, Disraeli's French was famously terrible. He was scarcely to be understood, and he was talked out of using French during the Congress itself. Disraeli's French was even worse than that of other British diplomats who had a famously terrible capacity in French. It was known as Foreign Office French and was famous for being both ungrammatical and perilously incoherent. In these negotiations, Bulgaria was scaled down by about a half of its territory, or intended territory. It was made autonomous. Macedonia was returned to the Ottomans. Independent Serbia and Montenegro were enlarged. Romania was made independent. And Austria-Hungary was given the right to temporarily occupy Bosnia-Herzegovina and the Sanjak of Novi Pazar. One might mention that temporary is significant here because, as you might well know, there's nothing quite as permanent as something that's declared temporary. The territories of Bosnia-Herzegovina and the Sanjak of Novi Pazar were particular strategic locations in the Balkans. And to my mind, the poetic sort of ringing sound of the Sanjak of Novi Pazar, just a small strip of territory, really says a lot about the romance that for many people surrounds diplomatic history. Bismarck himself was pleased with the negotiations. He expressed his admiration for Disraeli as a fellow diplomat, and at one point, famously during the negotiations, pointed across the room to Disraeli and said, "That's the man. That's the man." And that was high, high praise for a fellow diplomat. Britain, for its role in mediating all of this, gained Cyprus in the Mediterranean as a strategic outpost. But the outcome, in spite of Bismarck's initial pleasure, was, as it turns out, a fateful one. Russia, without quite being able to articulate the reasons why, felt somehow cheated by the entire proceedings. It had lost some of the gains it initially thought it had made. Russia felt cheated by Bismarck in particular and would mistrust him afterwards. Russia had lost prestige in the Balkans and increasingly was isolated diplomatically. There was also another very interesting moment in these negotiations. In an important innovation which shows the growing importance of human rights, the negotiators started to raise issues of religious and civic rights of minorities in the Balkan countries, especially Romanian Jews, who were subject to intense discrimination there. And though not much practically resulted from these discussions, this was really the first time in which the human rights and civic rights of small groups and minorities was actively on the table. Let's proceed now to examine another aspect of Bismarck's energetic attempts to weave a web of alliances that would ensure European stability. After the Congress of Berlin, in this more perilous environment, Bismarck steered a new course. He aimed to keep all of the great powers mutually entangled in alliances, which would place Germany at the center of the entire alliance system, so that Germany, in his effective formulation, would always be closer to each of the other powers than they were to each other. And France would have to remain isolated. He stressed this again and again. The result was a secret alliance, which largely ended up being kind of an open secret. Everyone knew something was up. But a secret alliance of Germany with Austria-Hungary against the possibility of Russian attack, the so-called dual alliance of 1879. It was intended to be a defensive pact and a restraint on Austro-Hungarian actions, and it became a cornerstone of German policy. It was secret until 1888, but was widely suspected at the time. It's very interesting to observe that over time, it changed from its initial defensive intent into something, as it turns out, far more volatile. And we'll follow this process in later lectures. Italy joined this alliance as an ally in 1882, angered at French actions in seizing Tunisia that it had wanted as a colonial possession for itself. The alliance required that Italy was to be defended if it was attacked by France, and in turn would support the others against any two other great powers other than Britain. This sounded very complicated, and indeed, Italy's adherence to this alliance would turn out to be quite tenuous. In 1881, the earlier Three Emperors Alliance was secretly renewed, and Bismarck hoped that he had established an effective web. But the Bulgarian crisis brought it to the test in 1885 to 1887. Austria-Hungary and Russia came close to war over the Eastern question. Bulgaria, which earlier had been a client of Russia, sought to annex Ottoman areas in revolt and was opposed by the other Balkan state of Serbia. Only Austrian intervention at the last moment stopped Serbia's complete crushing by Bulgaria, and the tensions in the region now grew. As the new Three Emperors League, which had just been renewed, broke down again, Bismarck desperately wanted to avoid having to choose between his allies, Austria-Hungary or Russia, fearing that if either got loose, it might ally with France. Bismarck then midwifed a secret set of agreements known as the Mediterranean Agreements of 1887, which sought to bring in Britain, Austria-Hungary, and Italy to oppose Russian expansion and to preserve the status quo. But for all of Bismarck's talents, he lacked the ability to solve that largest Eastern question, as we'll see. In a last expedient, in order to keep Russia in his web of alliances, Bismarck negotiated in 1887 the secret reinsurance treaty, which was just that, an attempt to reinsure Europe against war. As both Russia and Germany pledged neutrality in a coming war, with some provisos, unless Russia attacked Austria-Hungary first, or Germany attacked France first. The treaty was signed in June of 1887, and historians differ in their evaluations of whether this was a brilliant masterpiece of diplomacy or a last desperate expedient as Bismarck's system was breaking down even while he was still in office. This question became moot when Bismarck departed office in 1890. In 1888, 2 years previously, Kaiser Wilhelm I had died, and his son had died as well. So, in quick succession, the grandson of the first emperor of the new Germany, the brash young Kaiser Wilhelm II, came to power at the age of 29. Wilhelm II was a man gifted both with a lot of native intelligence as well as tremendous emotional instability. And historians who like to sort of engage without a license in psychoanalysis attribute some of his instability to a physical problem that he had. He had had a botched childbirth, and in the process, the doctor had damaged one of his arms. And some historians see Wilhelm II's later sort of militarism and macho posturing as an attempt to compensate for this perceived physical inadequacy. Wilhelm II, as we'll see in later lectures, made diplomatic catastrophes and blunder a personal specialty. After clashing with Wilhelm II about how foreign policy should be run, Bismarck was forced from office in March of 1890. And there was a famous political cartoon, perhaps the most famous political cartoon of the 19th century in Britain, that showed Bismarck being sent off of the ship of state as the pilot was being changed, as a new course would be steered in the ship of state. Nobody knew quite where, but people knew it was going to be fast and energetic. Wilhelm II, determined to make his own mark on German foreign policy, soon set about not renewing the reinsurance treaty with Russia. One reason for this was because German leaders were convinced that it was unnecessary. French and Russian political systems at home, they felt, were so different that the alliance between these two countries was virtually impossible. France was a democratic system, a republic. Russia was the most conservative autocracy there was. German diplomats in this immediate aftermath of Bismarck's departure had, in a sense, mislearned Bismarck's methods. They emphasized brinksmanship and forgot his gift for restraint. Bismarck's system, however, according to some historians, may already have been nearing a breakdown even before Bismarck left office, and one can certainly fault him for not cultivating people who could step in to replace him afterwards. This was a drawback to his determination to do it all alone. Let's conclude with a shock that followed upon Bismarck's leaving office. And that was the Franco-Russian alliance of 1894. Given what we just said about the certainty of German diplomats that it couldn't happen, this came as a bombshell. In spite of their ideological differences, both Russia and France, in spite of their different political systems, now became allies. And this was a key change in the international system. In that debate that we've followed in our course between realists and idealists, between those who claim that power political imperatives matter most and those who see ideology as mattering, realist observers would feel vindicated in their predictions at this moment. There were factors in addition to ideology that were at play. French investments in Russian industrial development that was just starting to take off in this time after a period of underdevelopment hurried along this relationship in economic terms. The tie was also one of convenience. Both sides had different aims and motives and strategic conceptions. The visits, mutual visits, of French and Russian fleets symbolized growing ties, and it led to bizarre scenes like the Russian Tsar standing at attention and in a gesture of respect while the Marseillaise was being played, which was, after all, an anthem opposed to monarchies from the days of the French Revolution. A military convention was then also signed in 1892, which became a full secret alliance by 1894, at first defensive in nature, but then also changing its character. When German diplomats got over their shock, they tried to do what the balance of power would probably predict, bringing Britain into the Triple Alliance. This would have seemed natural, and indeed, there were a lot of hopes in this regard until 1904, but erratic and unpredictable German foreign policy managed to ruin even this possibility. Bismarck died in 1898, and his last words are indicative of his sort of despair in the situation. His last words are reported to have been, "Impossible because of raison d'état," and then the final words, "Forward." Well, in conclusion, this era that we've traced in the lecture began with Bismarck's weaving of a succession of alliances, especially between Germany, Austria, and Russia as conservative powers, to keep Germany central and safe and France isolated. The lecture and the period ended with growing German isolation as France and Russia allied with one another after Bismarck had departed the scene. And now a very dangerous and rigid polarization of alliances would begin to set in Europe. But for a while, potential conflict would be projected outwards in violent imperial competition, which we'll discuss in our next lecture.